So to start our 3 days of work, we have Savas Dimopoulos from Stanford telling us, explaining exactly what I said before. Why is superaddians a good probe of new physics? What type of new physics? So, Savas?
Thank you. Is the mic?
Yes, it's on. It won't.
Hello?
You won't hear it from the. It's just the
okay, recording. As long as you can hear me. It's, yeah. So first of all, I want to thank Mina, Masha, Robert, and Will for organizing this conference, for their idea to bring observers together with astrophysical theorists and particle theorists in the same room for a few days to exchange ideas. I think we have entered, obviously, a golden era in physics. We are going to have a torrential flow of data in the next 5 to 10 years. So such interactions between observers and theorists are going to be very fruitful. Just looking around, I realized that most of the people already know what I'm going to talk about. But nevertheless, I was given this task to essentially define a common language and say things that people don't have to repeat in their talks. So let me begin with a traditional picture. So at 9:50 in the morning and 45 seconds Greenwich time, there was a new dawn of physics on September 15th, September 14th, 2015. And we entered the era of gravitational wave astronomy. Gravitational wave astronomy is, we expect, will be spectacular for a variety of reasons. The most obvious one is just a new eye, a new way to see the universe. But it's a very specific way. Gravitational waves, because of the fact that they interact so weakly, they go through most matter that we know of, you know, stars and galaxies, essentially undisturbed. So they give us direct information about the physics of the source that they are coming from. Again, because gravitational waves are so weakly coupled, the only events that can give rise to significant fluxes of gravitational waves are the most dramatic events in the universe, violent events like black hole mergers, or phase transitions, or inflation. So they give this is new phenomena that we haven't been able to study to in detail with ordinary astronomy. It will be a new precision science simply because there will be lots of data. We will reach a point where we have a few merger events per day, and each merger event has a lot of physics information in it. We are not going to be talking about these first two parts of the uses of gravitational waves. We are instead going to focus on the third question, whether black holes can be used to probe new physics. By new physics, I mean physics beyond the standard model, and I mean things like new particles, or new forces, or new dimensions of space, or time variations of fundamental constants, really novel phenomena that are not incorporated in the standard model of particle physics. The basic idea for what I'm going to be talking about is very simple. We will argue that black holes are excellent probes of particles whose Compton wavelength is of the order of the size of the black hole. And when I say of the order, that's an important qualification. I don't mean that it has to be exactly, it's not a resonance phenomenon where you exactly have to match the size of the black hole. But if you are anywhere within an order of magnitude or two from, if the Compton wavelength is within one or two orders of magnitude from the size of the black hole, the phenomena that I'm going to be talking about are going to be important. Now, of course, black holes come in several sizes from, let's say, order 1 to 10 to the 10 solar masses. So the range of particle masses that will be explored will have masses of 10 to minus 20 eV to 10 to minus 10 eV. For today's talk, we are going to mostly focus on astrophysical black holes. So we are going to be talking about the new particle searches around 10 to minus 10 electron volts. So the task that I've been given has two parts. One is to provide theoretical motivation for the existence of light particles. In particular, we'll focus exclusively on light bosons. And the second part will be about black hole superradiance that is familiar to many of you. And I'll talk about two aspects of black hole superradiance. First, the dynamics that gives rise to the phenomenon, and then potential observable signatures. So now I begin with theoretical motivation for light particles. And the first, and in a sense, the most conservative particle beyond the standard model, according to present-day theoretical beliefs, is there's something that's called the QCD axion. The QCD axion is a particle that was proposed in 1978 to solve an outstanding problem of particle physics, the so-called strong CP problem. And is this?
Yep.
Okay, yeah, okay. So, and it's well motivated for at least three reasons. First, it solves the strong CP problem that I will briefly sketch in a minute. Secondly, it is an excellent dark matter candidate. By an excellent dark matter candidate, I mean that there is also a cosmological way in which to produce its abundance and to have it in the universe as a dark matter particle in the right abundance. And the third is it's very well motivated by theories beyond the standard model, such as theories with extra dimensions or string theory. So for these three reasons, it's the most anticipated particle now for beyond the standard model. The way it arises is the following. In the fundamental interaction, let's say in the Hamiltonian of the standard model, you can add the term which is proportional to the dot product of the electric field and the magnetic fields associated with the strong interaction. So this is not the ordinary electric and magnetic field, but S stands for strong. This is the electric field associated with strong interaction. This is magnetic field associated with strong interaction. And so such a term is allowed to be in the Lagrangian of the theory. And it has a coefficient proportional to this quantity, theta. Okay? So this is called the theta angle of strong interactions. Now, in the presence of theta, you can compute or estimate the electric dipole moment of, let's say, the neutron, and you find that the electric dipole moment is essentially given by the size of the neutron times this quantity theta. Now, from known measurements or limits on electric dipole moment of the neutron, we conclude that theta has to be less than 10 to minus 10. So 10 to minus 10 is a small number, and physicists since the mid-70s, when this problem was realized, felt that it is so small that it begs for an explanation. And soon after that realization, Peccei and Quinn proposed the solution, a very ingenious solution of essentially replacing this quantity theta, turning this quantity theta into a dynamical variable. Okay, so theta, instead of being a constant, like the coupling constant, they promoted it to a field, which of course, just like feel like the electromagnetic field, except it has spin zero, which is a function of space and time. And they argued that the dynamics of this field is such that it is driven to a value, the state of minimum energy, is when this axion field is zero, therefore theta is zero. Okay, so that was the solution. The new particle turns out to have a mass, and the mass of this particle is given by this expression here, which I'll read this side, which is more relevant. So the mass is in proportional to 1 over 300 kilometers. So the characteristic scale for its Compton wavelength is 300 kilometers times a quantity, which is 10 to the 19 GV over F, where F is essentially the coupling. F is a measure of how strongly the particle couples to matter. So there is a unique relation. The axion is, of course, we don't know the axion mass, but we know this relation that given the axion mass, its coupling constant is determined and vice versa. So in searching for the QCD axion, we have essentially one unknown, the axion mass. In terms of the axion mass, its coupling constant is pretty well determined.
So is this extra term in the Lagrangian, is this the kind of term where quantum corrections would naturally generate non-zero values for theta s if theta s were zero in the Lagrangian? Or would it be perfectly natural and fine to just say that term's not there?
You can postulate without, if you take the standard model, you can add this term. You might say, oh, well, I can forbid this term by imposing CP invariance or time reversal invariance. However, the standard model is known to break time reversal invariance. So it's not a consistent hypothesis. So even if you set it to zero, corrections will induce it.
Okay.
Now, there are, I should say, this is not the only solution to the strong CP problem. There have been other solutions which make use of the fact that these radiative corrections that I'm talking about are very small. Okay. So there are some theories where theta can emerge to be small, not because of the existence of the axion, but because of some, you know, ultraviolet physics, some physics near the grand unification scale, and those solutions are also possible. The nice thing about the axion is that it doesn't depend on UV physics. The axion is a particle that emerges presumably from UV physics, but within the low energy theory, you can see the solution, the dynamical solution work. Okay, so now this is the most specific motivation for looking for these particles beyond the standard model. Now, the second motivation is very general, and it has to do with string theory. In particular, the second motivation is strongly connected with the now well-known fact that string theory has many, many solutions. It is, and that comes under the name of the many solutions of string theory or many universes of string theory. Each solution could represent a different theory or multiverse. Sometimes it's referred to as the multiverse of string theory. And let me tell you how this comes about. In string theory, string theory has, let's say, 10 dimensions. So there is the three dimensions of space plus six more dimensions that are in the theory, but we don't see it. We don't see them experimentally. So we can represent our view of the world in string theory as here is this flat plane, let's say this desk, represents our three-dimensional universe. Of course, it's two-dimensional, but it represents, let's say, a three-dimensional universe. And around on each point in this plane, you can imagine that there is a six-dimensional manifold. For each point on this in space, there is a six-dimensional manifold that lives on it that we don't observe. So this means that it must be very, very small so that our experiments have not gone at high enough energy or have not probed short enough distances to observe it. So this six-dimensional manifold we can just picture if we want pictorially like this. So this is one example of what the space of the extra six dimensions can be. It can be a six-dimensional sphere, for example, in this picture. And that's the simplest one of the simplest possibilities for how these extra six dimensions can be compactified. Now, of course, there are many six-dimensional manifolds. So another possibility is that the six dimensions are compactified into a donut, which is topologically a non-trivial configuration. It has one hole here. Or it can be a pretzel, which is even more, it's breakfast time. So it's a, so it, it has, it's topologically more non-trivial. It has two holes. Or you can keep going. You can imagine a very complicated manifold. And in six dimensions, clearly there is a lot of room for complexity. A complicated manifold that has many, many holes. Okay. And you know, it has a lot of tubes connecting things, and each tube has its own size. There is a lot of variables, a lot of parameters that would go into describing such a complicated manifold. Please.
Related question, and this may be very naive, especially with this latter example. What do you mean then by small? When you say at the beginning, you said this has to be small, but with which metric? How do you quantify?
Okay, small. Now, in traditional string theory, the size of the manifold is taken to be really small, which means the Planck length, 10 to minus 33 centimeters, or this length associated with the grand unification mass, which is close to that, it's 10 to minus 30 centimeters. On experiment, it's possible to have the size of these extra dimensions be as large as about 50 or 40 microns. And if there is two extra dimensions with 40 microns, for example, we wouldn't know it. You know, people have looked for small dimensions down to tens of microns, and they haven't found any. By doing tests of Newton's law at short distances with microscopic objects. So we know that these dimensions can be as small as the Planck length, or they can be as large as tens of microns. And that's model dependent.
Right, now I guess what confuses me is that you're still quantifying the dimension of these objects using our own 4D idea of size, right? So if I think again of your table, I can have a long rod, right? And in my dimension, the main dimension, the thing is very small because it's just the projection of a cylinder, say, but in the new dimension, it could be huge. So when you say it's small, you are the dimension of the projection of the thing in our space-time, or
what? Yeah, so what I mean is that our three dimensions, the only large dimensions in this theory are our three dimensions, X, Y, and Z. And all the other ones are small. And by small, I mean what I told you, between tens of microns and the Planck length.
There's a way where you can define the length of dimensions independent of the projection, which is gravity. Gravity sees everything. So when you go to short distances, Newton's law deviates. Instead of being 1 over r squared in ordinary three spatial dimensions, it becomes over, if you have one extra dimension, it becomes 1 over r cubed. So the point where you see the transition happen from r over squared to 1 over r cubed, you see it at a certain distance. That distance roughly sets the size of the extra dimensions. You can think about it this way. Yeah.
So now let me continue. So clearly there is a huge, an enormous number of six-dimensional manifolds, each one of which is a theoretical possibility for what how the extra dimensions, the space of extra dimensions, becomes compactified. And each one of these enormous numbers of possibility corresponds to a different three-dimensional theory. If you wish, a different standard model. For example, the spectrum, the particle spectrum of the theory that we observe in our three dimensions will depend on the details of compactification, how many holes it has, how large the various handles and the sizes of the extra dimensions are. In addition, all the coupling constants will depend on the geometry and the topology of this six-dimensional space. So all of the physics that we call, you know, three-dimensional physics, all of the physics in our universe depends on spectrum and coupling constants depends on the exact manifold. Now, the number of manifolds, it's hard to even define what you mean by the number of manifolds. In principle, there is a continuum of them. but it has been classified in the context of specific string theories, and you find, not surprisingly, enormous numbers, like 10 to the 500 in, so plenty of universes. So, that realization was a true phase transition in our expectations for string theory. Originally in the 80s, string theory was proposed as the unique theory, which is so well defined that we should be able to compute everything, you know, the electron mass, et cetera, in terms of, let's say, the Planck length. So it's true that the Lagrangian of field theory looks, of string theory looks unique, but it has so many solutions in it that the emerging 3+1 dimensional theory is by no means unique. Okay? And the totality of, okay. The totality of all of these different solutions or different universes is that emerge in string theory is called the multiverse. Now, associated with this complexity of string theory, there turns out to be an enormous variety of particles that emerge in string theory. So, because of the complexity of the extra-dimensional manifold, it turns out that you expect to have a lot of particles, a lot of light particles in the theory. So the complexity of the six-dimensional manifold results in tremendous variety of new light states. And to show you how one way in which these light states emerge, which is a topological reason for the existence of these light states, I'll go through a very simple example that all of you are familiar with, the example. Let's say you have a solenoid, and there is just a B field inside and no B field outside. And I will, for convenience, I'll turn the solenoid by 90 degrees so that it points towards you. Okay. And as we know very well from the Aharonov-Bohm effect, in this configuration, we have the characteristic that although electric and magnetic fields are zero outside the solenoids, nevertheless, the line integral of the vector potential is non-trivial. Okay? It has is non-trivial. Now, this is what we mean by the statement that, oh, the space now has a non-trivial topology. If you go once around this hole or once around the solenoid, you get a number. If you go twice, you get twice that number, etc. Now, the price for this non-trivial topology is that you have to have energy to create this configuration. In particular, you have to make this this solenoid. Now, in a topologically non-trivial space, you can replace the solenoid, you can eliminate the solenoid and replace it with a hole, okay? So this can be a region of a hole, by which I mean something that doesn't belong to the space. The space can be outside the hole. And in that case, you see that there is no energy price to pay for creating this topologically non-trivial gauge field configuration. So this would correspond in three dimensions to the existence of a massless particle associated with this non-trivial topology, the non-trivial Aharonov-Bohm topology. So this is the way in which a zero energy or zero mass configuration can emerge from non-trivial topology. Now, such phenomena resulting in light light bosons occur not only for spin zero particles, but also for spin one particles. Also, there are other candidates for light particles in string theory that come under the name of radion, moduli, and dilaton. And all of these particles have to do with the size and the shape of extra dimensions. So for example, there can be a scalar field. If this is one of the extra dimensions, then there can be a modulus that corresponds to the size of this extra dimension. So this would be a field whose fluctuations describe the fluctuations in the size of the extra dimensions. Okay. And and similarly, radion and dilatons, they are associated with, if you wish, breathing modes of the extra dimensional space. And in addition, of course, there is another potential light particle, which is the higher dimensional graviton, which can give rise to modifications of Newton's law at small distances. So there is plenty of candidate massless bosons in string theory. And
question.
Yes.
So you're saying that because we have all these solutions to string theory, because of the ways you can compactify these dimensions, we have multiple universes.
Exactly.
But how is this different from when you're just doing classical physics and let's say you solve a quadratic equation, but you know that there's one solution and the other is just mathematical junk that comes with it? So how is it not?
No, it's the same. It's the same. For example, it's the same. It's just a statement that there are many solutions. But this solution describes a universe. Each one of these solutions describes a new universe. That's the difference. I mean, mathematically, it's no different than saying that the bottle is a solution of the standard model. And that has some significance for me, but it doesn't have this cosmic significance. Oh, this corresponds to a new universe. Here I'm describing a manifold that exists on top of every point in space, in our space. So that solution. This slide has one more bit of information that the previous one didn't. That often the masses of these particles, often these particles start out life as being massless, and then they get masses from what are called non-perturbative processes that are similar to tunneling processes in quantum mechanics. So their masses turn out to be naturally very small. Even if the fundamental scale of the theory is the Planck mass, 10 to the 28 electron volts, the particle mass can be much lighter because it's related through this, tunneling-like quantum mechanical non-perturbative processes to an exponential of a very large negative number. And often this number turns out to be, one over essentially the inverse of the fine structure constant or proportional to it. So you get easily numbers like e to the minus a multiple of 137. It's very natural to get light particles, not exactly massless particles, coming out of the theory. This is as much as I want to say for the theoretical motivation. So I welcome, if there are more questions. Yes, please.
Wasn't clear why the axion is then preferred from what you described for the string theory?
Yeah, so the axion is one of the particles whose emergence can be understood from such a setup that I described.
So the same Lagrangian effect as you described in the standard model?
Yes, yes, exactly the same. So,
we do not necessarily couple the same, though. With just like the QCD axion. The QCD axion is a special one because it couples to the strong
okay.
And has this effect.
No, this is a good point. So let me say, there are two things. There is the QCD axion, that's an exceedingly concrete particle that does a job solving an outstanding problem and whose parameter space is one-dimensional. Given the mass, it's coupling. Now, most of the time, quite often, when I use the word axion, I may refer to some generalized axion that refers to a spinless particle that is very light. And I think it will be clear, I'll make it clear from the context, whether I'm talking specifically about the QCD axion or not. It turns out, for the stellar black holes that I will focus on, I am talking about the QCD axion. As you will see, as you saw when I wrote down this formula for the mass of the QCD axion, Notice that I wrote this on purpose. The mass of the QCD axion, if this coupling constant that measures the coupling of the axion is the Planck mass, which is a very natural scale for the coupling constant, then the Compton wavelength is 300 kilometers. And these are the characteristic length scales associated with these black holes that we are talking about.
This is obviously not the case for the other.
For the other axions, it may coincidentally be the case. The other axions have a mass and a coupling that are not so tightly related to each other. And they coincidentally may have Compton wavelengths of 100 kilometers or so. But the nice thing about the QCD axion is that for the most natural value of this coupling comes from Planck scale physics, the mass is in the right range. And that's one of the first things that excited us back in 2009 when we started working on black hole superradians and the QCD axion. The other ones will be essentially, will mostly care, for this talk, will mostly care about just the gravitational coupling of the particle, and we will ignore the effects of any other coupling due to these quantities F. And this is a good approximation for many of the things we're talking about.
Is that the case for many of these string theory fields, where I would think some of them would couple universally through the geometry? So are many of those possibilities already ruled out by not seeing extra long-range forces coupling through gravity?
Yes, absolutely. Yes, and absolutely. What I'll talk about here will have to do exclusively with the gravitational coupling of the particle. And I will be assuming that the other couplings are small enough to ignore for our purposes. And of course, and this will be a good approximation in many cases.
This is an important point. So even if the particles do not couple with us at all, they're just there in the theory, yeah, and they are forced to gravity, everything couples to gravity. So even if you have the universal coupling that all particles have to gravity, black hole superradians will be able to.
Right. I guess what I was not being clear enough about is, I mean, as in, for example, the classic dilaton field,
yeah,
would act exactly the same as the spin 2 degrees of freedom, mm-hmm, of gravity, but is already in some sense ruled out by,
right,
measurements of gravity.
Absolutely, yeah.
So these kinds of extremely light fields would generate fifth forces that have already,
yeah,
been ruled,
yeah,
out.
Yeah,
but only if they couple to matter directly,
okay,
yeah,
with a strength that is too large.
Yeah.
Axions are also pseudoscalars, so they are also coupled to spin. They don't mediate similar forces as the dilaton or the moduli.
Yeah,
so
that's why they're less constrained.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the axions we'll be talking about for stellar black hole superradians are the QCD axions, and they are not excluded in the parameter space.
Yeah, the QCD.
At least not by any other. Yeah. So now we come to. So this is the motivation. If the discussion of the motivation is over, I can now move to somewhat more familiar territory, which is black hole superradians. And to describe it, I will start with a very simple cartoon. Superradiance is a very general phenomenon, and I want to give you an intuition about it in the context of a simple model. Imagine that you have a cylinder, and you have a rough surface on the cylinder. okay? So this is a rough surface on the cylinder, and you have a ball. Now, if you aim the ball to the right, if the cylinder is not rotating and you aim the ball to the right, then the ball will touch this, let's call it sandpaper, and it will slow down. And this is what you expect. If you have a surface with friction, if you come in contact with it, you'll lose energy. And if, however, this cylinder is rotating rapidly, it's rotating so rapidly that the point that the cylinder is rotating faster, with faster angular velocity than the particle when it touches it, then you can see clearly that the friction will, instead of slowing down this ball, it will accelerate. And this is, of course, a very simple phenomenon. It's just the observation that if you have a dissipational surface like sandpaper at rest, then if you move relative to it and touch it, you'll slow down. But if the surface is moving, it can drag you and give energy to you. And that is the essence of superradiance. Now, so this is superradiance for point particles. For waves, it's a bit more subtle, and this has been worked out in several contexts, even in the context of electromagnetism by people like Zeldovich in the early 70s. And the corresponding phenomenon is that if you have a wave that is moving and this cylinder is rotating again, then as it goes through the cylinder, if the right conditions are related, if the angular frequency corresponding to the wave is smaller than the angular frequency of the cylinder, then the wave, the intensity of the wave will increase. Now, for black hole superradiance, it's exactly the same phenomenon, except you replace the sandpaper with the ergo region of the black hole. So the ergo region, so if you have a rapidly rotating black hole, the ergo region can drag a particle that is falling upon it and gain energy from it. So this is called the Penrose process, and it's illustrated here. So a wave packet comes here through the ergo region, then its amplitude increases. And around 1972, President Okolsky had a sort of fun papers pointing out that, well, if you could surround a black hole with a mirror, then you could repeat this process many times. And in that process, in that way, we could keep amplifying the amplitude of the wave more and more until the amplitude it would be so large that it would break the mirror. Now, turned out that this fun paper actually has a realization for a potentially realistic case, which is the case of a particle with a mass. For the case of a photon, superradiance can happen essentially once. A photon can pass by here, be dragged and accelerated, and its amplitude can increase once. However, if the photon or if a boson has a mass, then the mass will prevent it from leaving very far from the black hole, can prevent it. And so you will have a situation where the mass will act as a mirror, and that mirror will can force it to move several times and get an exponential amplification of its amplitude. So the picture that's emergent is that if you have a very rapidly rotating black hole, and if you have a particle whose Compton wavelength is comparable to the size of the black hole, the black hole can start creating around it, just by virtue of quantum fluctuations, it can create this massive boson in its neighborhood, and then the resulting wave can get exponentially amplified. Now, in so doing, notice that in so doing, the black hole will spin down. In so doing, the black hole will deposit some of its spin to the cloud of what I'll refer to the cloud of bosons or axions interchangeably, to this cloud of, and will slow down. And superradiance will stop when the central black hole lost so much angular momentum that it is not it's not rotating rapidly enough to cause superradiance. Okay. Now, the mathematical analysis of what I just described to you in these short movies is actually very simple, at least for the case when at least for the case when the mass of the particle, the mass of the axion, is relatively small. So the analogy to think in mind, yes, please.
I missed it. I guess a stupid question, but why would the cloud form in the first place?
I'll show you. Actually, in the end, there is mathematics. So I'll show you the math and then ask me again if it's unclear, okay? Yeah, this was very descriptive, okay? So so what happens is, so the analogy, the best analogy for the system, which is mathematically quite precise, is think of the nucleus, of think of the black hole as corresponding to an atomic nucleus. Think of the axion as being an analog of the electron, except the axion is a boson. So because it's a boson, many, many axions can find themselves in identical state. So you have a nucleus, namely the black hole. You have Bohr energy levels. And so this is like a gravitational atom. And the big difference is that the occupation number of any one energy level can be arbitrarily large in principle because we are dealing with boson. Now the analysis, this picture can be made, is a good one, as long as the analog of the gravitational, of the fine structure constant, this quantity alpha, which you can call the gravitational fine structure constant, is small, smaller than one. Okay. In that case, you have Bohr energy levels. This is the first term, the binding energy is just given by Rydberg formula. And the big difference from, there are two important differences from the hydrogen atom. One is that because they're bosons, you can have tremendous occupation numbers. The occupation numbers in what we'll be talking about will be humongous, 10 to the 77, before the black hole stops doesn't rotate anymore to populate these energy levels. The second crucial difference is in the boundary conditions. You see, this is just a Schrödinger problem, except for the fact that the electrons are bosons, okay, and the boundary condition at the origin is different. This is a crucial difference to give you runaway solutions. In normal hydrogen atom, the boundary conditions are some regularity conditions at the origin to make the wave function square integrable, etc. For black holes, the boundary conditions is that you can only allow incoming waves, no outgoing waves. And that is a key difference that converts this Schrödinger hydrogenic problem into a non-Hermitian problem. So you can easily figure out that the Hamiltonian now is no longer Hermitian because of essentially boundary terms that violate hermeticity. And it is that non-Hermitian aspect of the Hamiltonian which allows for exponentially growing solutions, you know, without violating unitarity, et cetera. It's not a unitary operator. So this is the key difference that accounts. This slide is just for fun. I don't have time to talk about this in detail, but just to let you know that superaddience is a fairly general phenomenon. The essential idea is what I was saying before, that you can have, let's say, a surface with friction, with some dissipation, moving faster than the particle that it's interacting with. And it can happen for a rotating cylinder with electromagnetic waves. Cherenkov radiation is similar, etc.
So you do have to have dissipation on the horizon in this case, or on your solar. Is there a limit, or do you have an idea of how much dissipation you practically need? For a given growth rate to actually unstable produce?
I'm not quite sure. The problem that I'm talking about that I defined here, that is defined here, tells you that if you want to see for the source of the dissipation that gives you the exponentially growth, you look at the boundary conditions. This is a fully well-defined mathematical problem.
No, I understand that, but let me imagine replacing a black hole
with something
that doesn't have a horizon and there's no dissipation.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's a very interesting question.
Yeah,
go, Marsha.
So the superaddience rates at which these states will grow is proportional to this absorption. So for black hole, absorption is unity, and anything that impinges on the horizon will be absorbed. If you replace that surface by something that absorbs 0.1 of the radiation, that will just be the coefficient in front of the rate, so everything will be slower by that factor.
So for example, you can calculate these coefficients around neutron stars if you have, say, some coupling to the matter in the neutron star, but for reasonable couplings, the dissipation there is rather inefficient, and it turns out those rates are very small.
So, here is a slide giving you some numbers for superradiance rate to give you an idea of orders of magnitude. In the most favorable case, the rate of superradiance, by which I mean a measure of how rapidly the cloud will grow. If you have at time zero a rapidly rotating black hole without any cloud, the time that it will take to grow this cloud will be about 10 to the 7 times the Schwarzschild radius. This is in the most favorable, fastest case. And so this could correspond, let's say, for a stellar mass black hole to about 100 seconds, very rapidly. And definitely very rapidly compared to the accretion rate of the black hole, which is about 10 to the 8 years. And you see now the dependence of the superradiance rate on various quantities in the case where the axion mass is large or the axion mass is small. There was a hand there. Yeah.
Yeah, so going back to, tag along to the question. So if you say this ideal case scenario that, let's say, 100 seconds, what it would be if I now replace a black hole by a neutron star? So, that 100 seconds would go to what?
It's longer than the age of the universe. That's the point.
So that would be the reasonable answer, or
no? Just assume gravitational interaction. I think that's the case. Yeah.
And
if you introduce extra interactions with the matter and the neutron star, you can start.
See, the problem is that the neutron star is Fermi. It's Fermi block. So if you want to absorb a very light particle inside mm-hmm. the neutron star, you can excite a neutron. But you have a very small phase space around the Fermi surface
mm-hmm.
that you can excite. So
yeah.
You get suppressed by that, even if you have a large coupling constant, which you cannot, because if it had a large coupling constant, then you would have seen it at other things.
What if instead of sending it to the neutron star, you had it in the magnetosphere around the pulsar?
Oh, the problem with the magnetosphere is actually quite asymmetric. That's another problem with neutron stars, is that they're quite asymmetric. The magnetosphere in a neutron star, it doesn't look like a perfect dipole. In fact, the dipole kind of looks like this with a broken axis, right? So that's another complication with a neutron star, that if you have not a perfectly axisymmetric object, then you have level mixing that causes non-superradiating levels to mix with superradiating levels. And then it suppresses the effect. So, in principle, you could. It's not forbidding. It's just that black holes are so efficient at this.
Yeah, I'm not suggesting mm-hmm. we look elsewhere. But mm-hmm. I'm wondering where we should look also.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you, yeah. So, if you put everything in there, we haven't been able to find, and we did try to look, any reasonable model of neutron star superradiance. There are papers out there that claim the contrary, but we don't think those have taken everything into account.
So I'm sorry, I'm very disruptive, I realize that. Can I ask one more question about the neutron star case? So if the Compton wavelength of the light boson is large in comparison to the star, then you'll collectively interact with the star, right?
Yeah.
And so is that included in the estimates that tell you?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Of course.
Yeah, yeah. So that's all right. You need to absorb something, right? So you need to absorb. So the key point is not just the binding will be done by gravity in all cases. So the gravitational atom is still there. You have to be careful because you can be inside the star.
Do
so
you have to absorb, or do you just have to scatter?
You have to absorb. You need dissipation. So you need a particle. You need a particle non-preserving process.
So why? I mean, from the very simple example you gave of the ball going on something.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Absorbed, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Just get a push.
Right.
Why?
I'm not sure.
There's loss of energy.
Energy
loss.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you could have that
here, and I make everything perfectly elastic. What still?
We need particle number non-conservation,
because
we're creating these. In order to create a large number of these things, we do need particle number number non-conservation.
Because that example is a bit misleading. Here, you're not changing the wavelength of the particle. You're producing new particle with the results. Right. So, the mechanistic example
is
misleading. The wave example is more faithful.
Right.
Sorry, one question. What is the rate at which the spin of the black hole is decreasing? Or what is the...
I think...
The rate at which the black hole angular momentum is decreasing.
Yes. What about...
What is the time scale for that?
The time scale is comparable to the time scale for the growth of the cloud.
So does it mean it's independent on the initial spin? So if it's 0.999 versus 0.5, it's still going to take under a second?
No, no, this was in the most favorable. What did you take for for the angular momentum? If it was...
It
does definitely know.
It does depend.
Yeah, it definitely depends, but I don't know for which rotation.
Sorry, one second.
And maybe this will be more clear when you go to the movie.
Yes.
Yeah. No, but
there's a movie.
Sorry, don't get too excited. Not.
Well,
this is not the proper simulations. Then this is a theorist movie, right?
It's at the same level as the previous movie. Yeah. So more questions. It's great to have discussions. Yes.
Yeah. Does this impart any momentum on the black hole? Do you get a kick from this kind of effect if you have some low-level asymmetry, or does the fact that you have such huge occupation numbers mean it's relatively symmetric?
No. I mean, this is an isolated. Let's say the problem is this is an isolated system, right? There is nothing. It's an isolated system. I don't think there is a kick.
You're not emitting anything to infinity, so there can't be any kick.
So now there are no more. Maybe some of more questions will come up when I start describing the time evolution. So evolution of superradiance, let's say for an axion. So you have a rapidly rotating black hole, and the first thing, let's say at time zero, you have a rapidly rotating black hole with zero axion cloud. You just created the black hole. The first thing that happens is that you have a growth of superradiantly unstable levels. So that creates a cloud and starts creating occupation numbers for the various hydrogenic energy levels. And there is a couple of processes in principle that can be caused by these occupied energy levels. One is you can have gravitational wave transition between different energy levels. Okay, so a number of axions can go from the excited to the lower energy level and emit gravitational waves. And what turns out to be more interesting, you can also have gravitational wave emission through annihilations of axions that are in the same energy level. So these are the, you know, some of the processes that are important. And to outline, to give you the movie that you were waiting for, of what happens in a specific situation. So consider, here is a lonely black hole that is born in, this is, the vertical axis is black hole spin. The horizontal is the mass. So let's say that you start with a 40 solar mass black hole with a spin which is 0.95 right here at time zero. Then as a result of superradiance, the black hole will spin down within a decade or so, I mean with the parameters that have been chosen, and they'll create this P wave. This is the radial wave function, effectively multiplied by R squared. This is the radial hydrogenic wave function times R squared. So you will, as you lose angular momentum, you are creating this axion, this axion cloud. So you reach a point when the superradiance condition for a P wave is no longer satisfied. However, a superradiant condition for a D wave can still be satisfied. I should say, one stop. When you reach this point of almost saturating the L equal 1 super radians, that's you have a lot of, well, a large number of bosons in this in a state. So you have a significant gravitational waves coming radiated by this cloud of bosons from annihilations.
So this yeah. must depend upon some interaction that you assume between...
The interaction is gravity.
That's right.
The interaction is...
coupling constant you're assuming.
No, no, it's just gravitation.
Gravitational coupling constant.
So this is, I don't know how, this is a graviton, and then there's another, this is, in principle, another... This is just a graviton that goes here. It just represents the Newtonian potential, so it's not a real suppression. It's just two axions gives you a graviton. So I am not in what we are discussing here. We don't have any other interactions than the one necessary interaction, which is gravity.
So the first stage generating the superradiant instability. This is just a linear instability of the evolution of the scalar field itself, and
it's an exponential instability.
Yeah.
It's not a linear instability.
Sorry, when I say linear, I mean linearized
exponent.
Stability.
It's
a linearized system.
Oh, yeah,
it's exponential.
The equation. Yes.
The second piece, this now is a nonlinear contribution, right? This is the interaction, the further interaction of that field
mm-hmm.
has grown. So what are the time scales and requirements for this? I would assume the secondary effect is much slower.
Yes, so this is, I mean, this is a measure of how slow it is. You can compute the density in the cloud, and this interaction goes like the occupation number squared. It involves the annihilation of two particles that are in the same state, the P wave state there. And yeah, so this is definitely a nonlinear.
For this.
Yeah, so this gives you an idea that the annihilation signal before you get rid of the cloud lasts 3,000 years.
Can you give me an idea of in the example of 40 solar masses, how much mass is in the cloud?
It's a small fraction. Is it percentage or percentage?
Percent level.
Yeah.
What it can be 10%.
But the bound is 29%, right? So imagine you got a maximum spinning black hole and you're going to deplete it just. But that's extreme case.
Yeah. So 29 is the total rotational energy you could extract from black hole. But if you're extracting a fixed frequency,
I'm sorry.
The gravitational wave signal would not be coherent.
It is coherent.
It is.
Yeah.
So maybe one way, so this is the particle picture. Maybe another way that you may be more familiar with is you can think of this as a stress energy tensor due to the scalar field outside of the black hole. And it carries a lot of energy and it has a time varying component because of the mass of the particle. So you'll have a time-varying stress-energy tensor which emits coherent gravitational wave radiation at twice the frequency of the mass.
Mm-hmm. Is this axion annihilation? Is it a coherent process?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Involves many axions.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But this is too light for a few CDX.
No.
Scale effect. That's the mass.
That's the mass if this coupling constant F is the Planck scale. Yeah.
The point is not to see this emission, right? The point is that
it is.
We're
no.
Well, in stochastic.
No.
Not from black hole. In stochastic gravitational waves. Okay.
So
over 3,000 years, losing that small, tiny fraction of mass over 3,000 years will generate an appreciable
yes.
Yes.
How close?
My natural state.
Okay. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
We can look at some estimates, but yeah, the idea is that you can look for these monochromatic gravitational waves because they're coherent and monochromatic, you can integrate for very long.
Right.
As many people doing such analyses know, you can improve the sensitivity.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Signal is very weak compared to.
For
example, merger. But the point is because it is very monochromatic, you can average the noise down and integrate for longer times.
Yeah.
So
actually, I'll show some plots that may quantify how strong the signal is. Yeah. Okay. So far. So L equal 1 super radians takes you down to this, and then L equal 2 can take over. So you emit gravitational waves for 3,000 years. Then in a million years or so, the L equal 2 super radians takes you, decreases the black hole spin further. And that is when, well, that's where the process stops. And it stops because the universe has a finite age and the black hole has. Essentially, this little blue that you have here would be, PDF, F wave super radians, which is even faster. So, F wave super radians happens very slowly because these F waves, you know, sit relatively far away, and the super radians, they don't see as much the dissipative region in the center. So that's where everything stops. In an infinitely old universe, you could have a situation where you would go, you would have continuous super radians.
If I imagine the whole thing at some finite temperature, so there would be higher states anyway populated by these bosons, couldn't you have some of the higher modes as well or not?
Yes.
Temperature.
It's not a thermal state.
It's not
a thermal state. This is not a thermal process.
First of all, in a completely empty space, if you start with a rotating black hole, you will have unavoidably quantum fluctuations that will create some seed axion field, and then the classical equations will take over and will grow the instability.
Actually, it will be Hawking quantum. So roughly, when you have that parameters, that's the stage through which Hawking radiation goes. You emit one Hawking quantum, it gets, it sits on that black hole, on that orbit, and then because it's boson, you create more and more of them. So
yeah.
It's a stage through this Hawking operation process goes for the black holes in the presence of light particles.
Yes, please.
Yeah, I'm a little bit confused of how the actions are formed, or you know, what determines the density that you need to make this process efficient. But how you keep talking about the actions, the action field, but what exactly determines how many of them are created? And
so, yeah, I can tell you. So the story is you have a fluctuation, so that a quantum fluctuation can create one axion, and then this amplification mechanism will take over and will grow the occupation number. So the occupation number, let's say, for this, for the P wave state, will start growing exponentially. As the occupation number increases, the black hole is losing spin. It's losing very little mass, but it's losing a lot of spin. And eventually it will slow down so much that you can you violate the condition for super radians. And the number is about 10 to the 77. When the number of axions is of 10 to the 77, that's when you have spun down the black hole to where it doesn't.
You need to start with a large number of axions.
No, you've been completely, that's a very important point. Yes, because some people think that axions have to be the dark matter they don't have to be the dark matter.
Questions here. Vladimir has not asked
a question.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But okay, it's just you're too democratic. Okay. Of course.
Could you comment on the shape of the curve? So do you get peaks because of the condition of the scale of 300 kilometers being somehow matched to the size of the black hole, or is it something different?
Yes, I mean, it's important.
You can see the black hole of 300 solar mass, right? So it seems to produce negligible signal, right? It is because the scales becomes larger, or is it something else?
No, the mass, this is the plot that I have here is for a specific mass.
I see. For specific mass of the particle.
Of the AI particle, yeah. So it's important that the Compton wavelength is not maybe within an order of magnitude or two of the size of the black hole. If it's too far away, the phenomenon, I mean, it will be suppressed. I mean, I had just shown, you know, as a function of, where did I have formula? Here. I mean, here you can sort of see how things are suppressed. M is the mass of the particle, and R is the size of the black hole. So this is this 0.4 means they are comparable, so this is sort of optimal case. But as the mass becomes very large or very small, then these corresponding superradiant time scales become long.
And so what about the spin down? So as we change the black hole mass, assuming the particle is matched, would the rate at which black hole spins down be the same on the order of...
It would follow.
It's proportional to the light crossing time, right? So there's a coefficient in front of the light crossing, Rg. So here, in these formulas, we use units where h bar and c are 1.
Uh-huh.
So the time scale is proportional to the light crossing time, essentially times the coefficient, which at optimal, it's 10 to the 7, roughly, the light crossing time. And if you are at very heavy masses, this becomes exponentially suppressed. So yes, for heavier black holes, so if it's 10 years for a 40 solar mass black hole, if you scale everything up, keeping the mu times Rg constant, then the time scale for a 400 solar mass black hole, it would be 100 years. And then it will be proportional to the mass of the black hole. It will become longer and longer for heavier black holes to do this process.
But you wouldn't want to keep mu Rg constant. You want to propose that there is some field in the universe with some fixed
no,
mu.
No.
Yeah, of course.
He was asking, yeah.
I think that's what he was asking.
No,
right, this is what I was asking, because there are observations of supermassive black holes with large spins, right? And since we know they exist and they've been there for a while, so I wondered what exactly does it imply about... So I think the answer was that for a really large black hole, it will just take a long time to spin down.
Yes, but so there is a range. So in principle, the size of astrophysical black holes that Savas showed in his first slide is that it goes anywhere from a kilometer to 10 to the 10 kilometers for these ultra-massive,
mm-hmm.
supermassive black holes. So that means that in each range, you can imagine you match that you probe particles with similar Compton wavelength. So it's roughly 10 orders of magnitude in principle that are probed by astrophysical black holes. Here we're restricting ourselves to stellar mass black holes because of LIGO, but in principle, supermassive black holes can exhibit this process. You just have to be a bit more careful because supermassive black holes have huge accretion disks, they have different
mm-hmm.
environments. The spin, it's not like they are born with very large spin. You have to see how they accrete the spin. So the evolution is slightly a bit more complicated. The measurements are different. Jack will talk about it, right?
I was mostly going to talk about solar mass.
But
I can comment on it.
My question is exactly on this, and maybe Jack will have the answer to that.
Mm-hmm.
But some of the stellar mass black hole in X-ray binaries have spin of 0.98 or something.
Yeah, we'll come to this.
So unless we are incredibly lucky, we're looking at these systems like in the 10 years where... But even then, I mean, even if they are spinning up because of the disk, the process seems much faster spinning
right.
down than the disk can spin them up.
So
why don't we see any variation of spins in this? So is observing X-ray binaries with the large spins already putting a bound?
Of course.
Yes. You talk about it.
No, this is great.
No, we're already 10 minutes past time. So talk about. It's mostly our fault. But
it's okay.
Wait,
no,
wait.
The idea is to discuss. So it's you. This thing will be answered.
Okay.
Yeah.
The colloquium anyway.
Yeah.
It may take that long. No, but that's the idea. Yes, please.
So you might say it again, this will be answered later, but you know, since you're talking about Christian disks, I had the question whether the presence of matter will affect the process of super radiance at all or not. What is the
Well, the here you see the accretion time scale is very, very long. So it's a very, whereas the superradiance is very short. Superradiance is 100 seconds, accretion 10 to the 8 years. So it's a very slow slow process, and it won't affect
The question is not about
the dynamics.
The time scale for spinning up, but just whether there's interaction.
Right. We estimated this, and it is a tiny perturbation. It's an important, what you are asking, No, what you're asking is a very important question because superradiance can be spoiled by breaking symmetries that would mix superradiant and non-superradiant letters. It's an extremely important question. We have checked that at any moment the accretion is a very small interaction. So there's small, very small perturbation to disturb this picture.
This is the point. Everything happens in a few tens Schwarzschild radii, and there is a very small amount of matter in the accretion disk of black hole in this region compared to black hole mass.
So as long as we're asking just questions.
Please.
So what happens for black hole binary, right?
We should have another talk.
Yeah.
You know, we had a great talk from a student. We can say your name because I will butcher it if I pronounce it. So maybe we can have an extra
discussion.
Oh,
can we talk during the colloquium?
During the colloquium.
Yes, in principle, yes, you can have. So when we first estimated the effects of the environment, we in fact overestimated them, and we still found them not to be a problem. So Hong Seng from did I say it correctly?
Yes.
From Amsterdam.
from Amsterdam, they calculated properly, more carefully, the effects of the mixing. So what it does, an accretion disk, it spoils the axial symmetry of the black hole.
She's talking about the talk she didn't go to.
About.
What? Yes.
Two black holes.
Yes. So the presence of the black hole breaks, it's a tidal force on the cloud. So the fact that you have this tidal force, it mixes again non-superradiant levels to superradiant levels.
Yes, but wouldn't there also be trajectories that go around both black holes?
What do you mean? The separation is too large. I mean, the cloud is a few Schwarzschild radii.
Right, collapse?
Yeah, so right before the collapse, the perturbation is so large that the cloud is already gone, right before the two merge into each other. But there could be regimes that the cloud survives for long enough when the black holes are far away from each other that you may get some sort of resonant effects in that case. So, and they wrote a paper about it.
Yeah,
maybe
we can save this for a discussion. It's a very interesting question.
Yes.
Yeah, any other? There was another. So let's continue. Okay, so this concludes. Yeah, and here you see the growth of the D wave when you go through this phase. Okay. So, yeah, and well, that's where it ends. So that's where I was before. Now we come to a question that was asked, which is type of limits or what type of constraints existing data may place on some on some axions. So this is a plot valid for an axion mass of 10 to the minus 11 eV. It's different than the previous mass, slide mass. So again, it's the plot of the black hole spin versus black hole mass. And the existence of these very rapidly rotating black holes, especially up here, seems to disfavor axion masses that are 10 to the minus 11 eV. Effectively, what this plot tells us is that we would have expected any axions that are in any of the blue regions to drop its spin. And so all of the black holes in the blue region should have dropped this spin. And therefore, all their numbers there should be accumulated along this boundary. So, you know, a dream scenario is experiments take a lot of data, that you will look at such a plot and you will find a line. And from the line, you can reverse engineer and read the axion mass. So of course, this will have to wait plethora of data. It will require measuring the spins and the masses of a large numbers of black hole. But eventually, this may well happen. And you know, such a boundary would be indicative of a new boson. So already there are constraints. So in fact, this says essentially in more detail what I just said. Let's say that you start with some black hole spin versus mass distribution that looks as follows. It's flat in spin, the distribution, and let's say it's a power law. I think it's mass to the minus 3.5 or something, power law. So this is, you know, the way the black holes are born, say, after some time evolution, due to the phenomenon of superaddience, if there is an axion of this mass, 6 times 10 minus 13, you would expect all the black holes that are highly spinning to come down to this, and there should be an accumulation along this line. So this is the type of, you know, theoretical dream scenario. Of course, there are things called error bars, et cetera, that we, in fact, we had in a, that won't make the picture so clear. But for more on this, we can discuss.
But here you are using a value of mu a, which has been excluded in the previous slides, or I remember.
No, no. This is 6 times 10 minus
1.
It's allowed.
What's allowed?
No, no. The interval was excluded, but this is right on the edge.
Okay. So, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought L equals 3 was prohibitively long in time scales.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right, in the example that we gave.
This is a plot that changes the black hole mass. So before he fixed the black hole mass for 40 solar masses, now it's over there, it's 80 or 100 solar masses. So these are, he fixed the particle size, but it's a different black hole that is active on this plot.
Okay, so that time scale is really...
Yeah, so this is taking, this plot takes into account the merger, the time scale it takes to evolve. So it is much shorter. I think it's even shorter than the age of the universe in this case. I'm not sure.
Yeah, it is.
I think it's the accretion time scale.
Well, basically, the idea here is that before there's the 40 solar mass black hole, right, which was not very well matched to the 6 times 10 to minus 13 particle, but the 80 to 100 solar mass black holes are better matched to that Compton wavelength, so they've been down faster.
Yeah. So this is one of the potentially observable signatures of the existence of such a particle.
Then this is saying that for black holes less than say 15 solar masses, you're allowed to have high spin all over the place, right?
Yeah.
So this kind of
matches for this mass.
For this one. But the one that you showed in the previous slide was...
Is disfavored. That was 10 to the minus 11. This is 6 times 10 to the minus 13.
So if you were to increase the mass of the particle, make the Compton wavelength smaller, this entire thing would shift to the left. Or if you were to make the particle lighter, it would shift to the right.
So my point is right now you could already said something about it.
Yes, we did.
You can say that...
We did.
This should be at least larger than some value.
Yes, so this is...
This is what we said. This is... this mass is excluded because of these two points.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Please, yes.
Question. Jen, do you have a selection bias in finding X-ray binaries with large spins rather than small spins? Detecting them in the first place?
No, so basically any black hole in our galaxy... the thing that we're biased to is we detect binary systems.
Right.
So which, if there's some mechanism by which binaries have some tend to have some spin distribution that's not representative of the
rest
black holes as a population, that's our bias.
So Jack will be talking later today. So that we can get through all the signatures.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this was. Did you have a question? No. Okay. So this is now I'm going to switch now to talk about more direct, if you wish, signatures. So, the direct signature, the first direct signature comes from annihilations. It's the same diagram I drew on the board. So you have this cloud. The cloud has 10 to the 77 axions. So any two of the 10 to the 77 axions can come together and produce a graviton. That's the particle physics language. And they produce, the outgoing graviton has an energy which is approximately twice the mass of the axion. And I say approximately because there is also some binding energy. Each axion has, in addition to its rest mass, some Rydberg binding energy. So it's a little bit, so this is an approximate relation. So this gives rise to high frequency gravitational waves with this, these parameters. The signal duration, of course, has been computed, and is this is the peak strain. It's you can read it off from here. For an object 1 kiloparsec away is 10^-22. And an interesting signature of this is that the signal frequency drifts upwards in time. And this is not this is a very interesting effect, because the signature, the frequency drifts upwards. The reason why it drifts upwards is very, very interesting. What happens is that, remember I was just alluding to binding effects, and the binding effects, as the cloud decays, the cloud mass decreases. So this means there is a bit of less negative binding energy to the cloud. So there is because of that, there is a positive shift in the frequency. 2m minus the binding energy increases a bit, and it increases by this rate, about 10^-12 hertz per second.
But the frequency
for these parameters
constant, right? Depends on the mass of the axions.
No. It's mass. It's twice the mass because you annihilate two, but each one of them had energy which is m minus Rydberg minus the binding energy. So it's not exactly twice the mass. Shifted a bit.
The main mass does not depend on the mass of the black hole. So
yeah.
The frequency of the emission,
yeah.
The main frequency,
the main,
not the delta.
Yeah.
This is quite a large amplitude as far as these things go. So I want to understand the different. What are alpha and delta? I'm sure you said it.
Yeah, so alpha is the gravitational fine structure constant, which is g newton times the mass of the black hole times the mass of the axion. And there must be h bar c's, but.
Yeah.
But this, I'm a particle physicist. Don't hold me responsible
here
for.
You don't need to have H bars and C's. It's right.
That's actually true.
Yes.
It's you can stick completely with. Well, C you may need. H bar you definitely don't need. Okay, and L is the L of the angular momentum, etc.
It's about
9.
Yeah, it's 4L plus 5 roughly.
This P, yeah.
So P is 4L plus 5?
Oh, sorry, it's what? It's, sorry.
Yeah, so for the leading level,
yes.
This is about, well, 18, I guess. So
yes.
P over 2 is 9.
Yeah.
So it's
mm-hmm.
a high power of
yes.
this alpha.
That can be
Yeah.
Can you remind us, for black holes within the range 10 to 100 solar masses, which axion masses give us Rydberg content with constants of order unity? Because that's the ideal.
So here,
right?
here show a plot in the
oh,
I mean, it's the frequency.
The next block. I know you showed it before.
No, there's another plot. There's another plot.
Okay.
So
maybe I should move.
Yeah, we need to move at some point. I mean, this is very important.
No, but this is the most important plot.
Yes, so there you go.
Okay, so I claim that this is even more important. Okay, so this is so these are coming back to direct signatures, and these are direct signatures coming from annihilations. Okay, so on the vertical axis, you have the number, the expected detectable sources that we are exposed to, and on the horizontal axis is the axion mass. Okay. And this gray region, by the way, that is the region that is disfavored by the already observed rapidly rotating black holes. Okay. So this blue band gives you an idea of the expectations for the number of sources that we expect to be simultaneously exposed to at any one time. Due to axion annihilations. Okay. So you see that we can be, for optimal parameters, which is around here, we can be exposed to as many as 10 to the 4 or so, 10,000 sources. And in fact, even the existing, this slight gray area here shows that the existing advanced LIGO data are already excluding as to see, for example, order 10 to the 5 sources, to be exposed to 10 to 5 sources simultaneously. So this is, gives you a measure of the types of signatures we would expect under, you know, various hypotheses here.
Sorry, I get confused by this number. Seems very large because this, the reach you showed before was on the order of kiloparsec, which is comparable to core collapse supernovae, say. And we're not going to see 10 to the 4 core collapse supernovae.
And this come from the galaxy.
There's a large population of black holes.
Yeah, but yeah. How quickly are they spinning?
Yeah. Right?
No, this is not the spin-down, this is the annihilation signal.
Right. Eventually, so I thought the picture was the black hole gets born with a large spin, you grow a scalar field, the black hole spins down, mm-hmm. the scalar field then over a longer period of time annihilates.
Exactly.
If that period of time is still 3,000 years, then that's there have only been 300 at most core collapse supernova in the galaxy in those 3,000 years.
Yeah,
which
exactly.
Means that
so that would give you the, so that would give you this around 100.
Right, but that's
the signals can last for millions of
years,
in which case you multiply
so
that number. Yeah, exactly. That's the right estimate to be.
Because that does.
Sorry, which signal lasts a million years?
So that's 3,000 years was one example, but
right.
It varies as a high power of
okay,
this
okay,
coupling.
Okay.
So it can be a million
okay.
years, it can be up to a billion years.
Okay.
So then you get...
And this accounts for all of those aspects,
yeah.
Got it.
So then here, these signatures mostly come from our galaxy. So these are black holes that are inside our galaxy. So it's not... So advanced LIGO won't be able to see for this type of search, won't be able to see extragalactic sources. So it still comes from our galaxy, it's just that you can have isolated black holes that still have a bit of cloud around them. It's just emitting stuff.
What is the highest spin black hole that's known in our galaxy?
I think X-ray, yeah.
Essentially one. I mean, we have a few that are at the limit. We can tell it's essentially one.
Do those have both continuous fitting and iron line?
Yeah.
Both.
Okay. Savas only has 2 minutes left.
Yeah, 2 minutes. Okay. Did I start at 11 or at 10:30? Oh, I see. Okay.
10:40.
Okay. Okay. So then I'll go very rapidly. But the audience took a third of the time, and that's exactly what we wanted, and that's the idea of the workshop. And okay. So now there is another signature. So this comes from annihilations. There is, of course, also transitions. And so I won't go over this in detail. It's just if you have two occupied energy levels, then you can have gravitational waves due to transitions. And this is how long they last. And this is the strength. The strain is smaller. Of the order of 10 minus 25 for a black hole, 10 kiloparsecs. The frequency, of course, also drifts up for the same reason as before, as you lose cloud mass, the particles become less bound.
So they increase. Similar to what you showed for the strain, as in the previous.
What are you pointing at? Oh, the last formula? Yeah, it's different.
Which is just a number instead of the scaling. That's all.
Oh, we don't have the scaling here.
Yeah, it's quadrupole. You can estimate it as a quadrupole. This is ordinary quadrupole emission.
Right.
So it's not.
Yeah.
Can you make the slides public? I would like to have these numbers handy. So easy to find.
Yeah, all of the talks are recorded in the slides.
So this depends upon the SDR to just the asymmetries of that, right? The quadrupole.
Yes, yes.
So the transition there is just a quadrupole transition you can estimate. So then you can, even the usual naive quadrupole estimate will give you the right answer in this case, taking the frequency to be the energy splitting.
So for transitions, the numbers are not as interesting. So you see, you expect this is the expected. I mean, it's less. It's small, and most signatures will come from things that are 10 megaparsecs away, 10 kiloparsecs away.
This is all in the galaxy.
This is all in the galaxy, but anyway, the number is very small. And
I guess for these plots, you're taking some integrated optimal signal noise ratio, or
yes.
So we assume a coherence time. So total data of 1 year and coherence times of 2 days.
And now a more interesting case is the following. Imagine that you have a merger, okay? So, and you know that the merger results in a final black hole, and which is rapidly spinning. Then, from such events, the expected number of events per year, as a function of the axion mass, you see here, again, the masses, the results, at least for near-term observatories, is not very encouraging. You may see order one events, but future observatories may have the possibility of looking for real-time mergers. The superaddians due to black holes that were just freshly formed as a result of a merger.
Tell us here, are you assuming, when you say final highly spinning black hole, what are you assuming? Because you cannot have it both ways. So if it was already active and depleted the spin, so the maximum spin of the black hole is has a severe cutoff. Right?
Yeah.
It would be at most 0.67.
Yeah, so this actually assumes that the black holes, initial black holes had formed close, so they didn't spin down very much because of some mixing.
Oh,
events. And
you're
then we use your formula to calculate the,
So this depends a lot, as you pointed out, this depends a lot on what the black hole spin distribution post-merger is. So it depends a lot on what the formation mechanism of the binary is, and what happens before. No, that is definitely...
Are these sources in our... I don't understand, where are these?
These are 10 megabytes.
Enhancing the signal so much. I thought we needed to wait until the scalar hair built up to a large level so that annihilation rates are very strong. Right, but this would be right after being born.
Yeah.
These things don't have a strong scalar cloud, so why?
Well, it builds fairly rapidly.
So these are black holes for which this is a different population of black holes, essentially. So these are black holes that are formed after a merger.
I understand. So right after merger.
And then the requirement is that actually the black hole builds within a year or so.
Okay.
So the cloud forms within a year or so. So basically, after a year after the merger. Because, so basically, alpha is so large that the signal is very strong.
It's enhanced by high alpha.
Alpha
to the 9 halves, we have a strong enhancement in H.
Exactly.
But then these die very quickly, they're rare strong sources.
Exactly.
Okay.
But this, you would be sensitive to right after the merger when you would know when the black hole is born. So the other monochromatic search is looking for black holes that have had superaddians a long time ago and they still have a remnant cloud around them. So it's a different population that's probably.
You gave me 2 minutes, but you took more than 2 minutes yourself. I think we got the picture.
Yes, okay.
A lot to look forward to.